Jazz. All right. Let's see. What the fuck number is this one? Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 139. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike. Party on, Pat.
Yep. We're doing some party jazz tonight. You know, I was going to open with a question. Do you know how far apart we are right now? I finally checked.
Golly. On the map, you mean?
Yep, on the map.
Am I allowed to guess?
Sure.
I don't know. Let's see. Time zones. 10,000 miles.
Okay. A little high there. I checked, and roughly speaking, 5,500 miles. That's still a pretty good long distance.
Why have you checked this information?
I was just curious. I'm like, well, I never thought.
Oh, this isn't a bit. This is just curiosity.
Yeah, no, there's no, yeah, it's not going anywhere. Just, you know.
I thought it was a bit, maybe. Okay.
You presume too much. Now, I didn't work anything up more interesting other than noting that the two members of the Jazz Bastard podcast, more than 5,000 miles apart while I'm here in Sweden.
I am the fixed foot, and you are the wandering foot.
That's right. Just John Donne should write a poem about us.
If only.
It began, boy, they suck, and then he realized it wasn't iambic, and he gave up.
Gold to airy thinness beat.
Yeah, yes. Something like that, yes. To polish yet another turd. Okay, well, instead of trying to do some faux done here, we're going to talk about some party jazz. This is a project that's been bubbling in the back of my mind for a while, and it was kind of given new impetus when I saw the group Black Flower live here in Malmö. And we didn't get to do one of their recordings, though in a sense I kind of wish I could have stuck one in, but they kind of sharpened the point to me, and that doesn't really make any sense, but kind of, you know, convinced me that, yeah, there's kind of a couple genres out there of what I might consider party jazz. I mean, we'll be talking about music today that, for the most part, is to get your butt shaken rather than your beard stroking. And maybe one thing we'll ask us to think about is what the jazz content of each of these albums is, what we think the appeal for them might be for a jazz listener.
Mm.
Anyway, the works selected are kind of out of two traditions. Well, maybe three. One being, I tend to think of, even though, you know, if you listen to Louis Armstrong and music from that era, I don't really hear the second line so-called rhythms, the kind of mix of march and funk beats that you hear in well-known New Orleans artists. Apparently that tradition was around for a long time. But I don't know. I tend to think of hearing it more often in music from the 60s forward. I don't know what its recorded legacy is before that. But we have a couple acts that are kind of either based in New Orleans or drawing from it. The Preservation Hall Jazz Band in 2013 released an album called That's It. And its selling point was it was the first record that was comprised entirely of originals. There were no covers on it. And then saxophone player Craig Handy, who has got a long and starry career as a sideman in various projects, released Craig Handy and Second Line Smith in 2014. And I had not fully understood the meaning of that title, but the idea was he was combining Second Line New Orleans rhythms with Jimmy Smith pieces. I had not made that connection. So my love for Jimmy Smith is well known, and Craig also has love for that artist, and I guess most of the songs here are either compositions by or songs associated with Jimmy Smith. I'm not sure where to put the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. They're kind of their own thing. I guess you can hear some hip-hop beats, but anyway, we're doing their EP, really, Hypnotic Joints, from 2017. And then Red Barat, Shruggy G, from 2013, is a one of a band like Black Flower that combines various kinds of, I don't know, again, I don't like to call it ethnic music because all music is ethnic
right,
music.
But they're specifically, they're doing Bhangra along with, they're doing this Indian, right. they actually cover, one of the songs is a cover of a popular title of Indian or music associated with Bengal, Bangladesh, so. Yeah, they're
kind of combining some traditions from Indian music along with the kind of the brass band tradition and Black Flower in a more psychedelic vein, which we won't be talking about, also brought in some Middle Eastern influences along with the party idea. And I'd say in their case, you know, influence from artists like Led Zeppelin, progressive rock, that sort of thing. None of these bands, I'd say, are drawing quite on that particular influence of progressive rock. All of them have one feature that I think Mike enjoyed immensely. And that
tuba!
Is what?
More tuba! Or sousaphone. Yeah.
I had no idea when I picked these out. I realized, yeah, you're right. Every goddamn one of them has a lot of tuba. And maybe we can think briefly about the reason that tuba finds a place in party jazz in a way that it doesn't very often in modern jazz. You know, I wrote an article on Black Flower and talked about, is there such a thing as IPM, instrumental party music? I don't know. A lot of these have some or many vocals on them, but I guess in a sense, we're thinking about the genre tonight. You know, what do musicians with some jazz background do when they want to create a music that has got some more populist appeal, that is more music for use, but don't want to completely abandon their roots in jazz? Any preferences to where we begin here? I really don't have an agenda.
Doesn't matter to me.
Okay, well, let's go back to the longest lived of these ensembles. That would be Preservation Hall Jazz Band and their release, That's It. I did a little research online. Preservation Hall Jazz Band apparently was founded in the early 60s and was led by a tuba player named Alan Jaffe, but mostly populated with musicians in their 60s through their 90s at that time. And it was kind of an ongoing, I don't know, I tend to think of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band as as much of a tourist attraction or a kind of a New Orleans landmark as I do a musical institution or someone that I would follow as a jazz fan. I remember seeing them back in the late 80s, which is now a long time ago. Have you kind of explored their music before now?
I only have one of their CDs, and it's a, if memory serves, it's a Live Date, Kel Surprise, and of course all covers. And I just think of them as, when I think of them, if I think of them at all, which is not very often, I think of them as a kind of legacy band. They're a great example of a band that has existed and continues to exist over time and that mines a particular tradition that is emblematic of preserving a tradition. You know, the title of the band kind of tells you what they're about. They're associated with Preservation Hall in New Orleans, but also they're into preserving a particular kind of sound, which they do really well. The disc I have by them it's just a best of disc and enjoyable, but nothing particularly stands out about that. So it was interesting to note that they did an album of all originals. That's kind of a new thing for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that it was probably born out of both perceived artistic necessity. In other words, that they had a lot of younger members who maybe, you know, obviously did not have kind of the memory of those old times as the musicians they had, who at least had probably known as young people the early generations of New Orleans jazz.
Well, you know, in their earliest iterations, some of the players who sidelined with them, George Lewis, famously the clarinetist, was connected to an early version of the band. And through George Lewis, who enjoyed a kind of 50s renaissance as a Dixieland avatar, they had this link back to the origins of the tradition. So they've always been deeply rooted, or at least their past discography has deeply rooted them in a particular sound associated with New Orleans from the very beginning. That's what they do.
And as time has gone by and the band has, the personnel has shifted and morphed, you know, that connection of necessity, time takes us all away, you know, got thinner and thinner. And I assume there were young members who probably were more interested in trying something new. Also, clearly, this particular project was a good narrative gambit by the organization. In other words, it is news that they are playing all originals. It is kind of man bites dog then, because this was a group known as you said, a legacy band. And this was on Sony, so it's like the, you know, the biggest label release of all these, even though I don't know that most jazz fans would consider them necessarily the most artistically important group. It's a known brand name. It is, again, it's kind of a tourist attraction thing. It's somebody who's never heard of jazz might know about. Apparently what happened was the son of the now deceased original kind of leader, who himself, I think, was arrived at New Orleans and kind of was assigned to kind of nurture this band, has been leading it for a while and trying to find new venues to kind of showcase the music in, did some collaborations with other artists, basically trying to kind of expand their mission statement a bit beyond sounding like what people think jazz in the 20s might have sounded like, whether or not it did. So, yeah, this was kind of an oddity. I ran across a review of it, I think at the time, which has been a few years now. I thought, well, you know, I never owned anything by this group. Maybe I should try this. And so in that case, the marketing worked. And, you know, this is, I don't know, how would you characterize this album? I found it enjoyable. I think there's some pretty good high points.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. One of the reviews that I looked at said it's striking how it's an album of all originals that yet sounds like they're all covers. And there's something to that. You know, even though these are originals, they are clearly within a certain tradition. This stuff doesn't get too far out, although there are a few numbers that are kind of surprising or just hard to know what to make of. So, for example, Emelina's Lullaby just sounds like it's played on a saloon piano in an echo chamber, and there's nothing else. It's only like 2 minutes long, but it's you kind of hear it and you're like, the hell is that? And it's kind of interesting because it has a natural old-timey sound, if you will, but is obviously not an old-timey song since it's recorded by these guys, you know? So that's kind of hard to know what to make of. But yeah, a lot of the songs are things that as soon as you hear them, you go, I can place that in a tradition. But of course, they're originals, and I kind of like that. I don't know that anything here stands out as extraordinary in terms of like, you know, a new addition to the gas. But, you know, some of the songs are just like, for example, The Darker It Gets, right? As soon as it starts, you're like, if you knew nothing about genres of jazz, before the vocals start on that song, as soon as it starts, you're like, New Orleans, you just know. Like, you know, you have a geographical marker instantly, sonically. Even if you're a novice to the music, you're going to think, it's going to place, that music is going to be, you know that these aren't guys in berets with shades in a dark, smoky club. As soon as you hear those opening chords, you know what you're in for. And it's kind of striking to me that they do that in song after song. They kind of tap into this feel, this sound. They deploy a host of techniques that are common in this music, and they just yoke them to originals. So we even have a sort of semi-spiritual number here, right? Dear Lord, give me the strength, which that's a part of that tradition as well, because some of these second line bands they're known for their presence at funerals, playing at memorial occasions. And there is a deeply spiritual component to this strand of music. And by God, they churn one out. Yeah. I don't know that I could, well, I'll single out some things that I really like. Of course, like the tuba here, yay, or sousaphone, whatever it is he's playing. I dig it. I always like that as a substitute for bass. There's a filthy good trumpet player on here. I don't know who that is, but he's awfully good. There are several solos or several just moments where he stands out that I think sound pretty extraordinary. But maybe the thing I like best here is they're kind of locked in the sense that Wynton Marsalis has talked about this, and to some degree, this is going to be a Things We Like About Wynton podcast, I suppose. He's right in that to play in this tradition actually requires a certain amount of skill. There's a great deal of interlocking rhythmic elements that require various members to improvise at the ends of lines. You get a lot of portamento, trombone, or whatever you want to call that, where they sort of, the sort of gut bucket trombone that leads over a line. You get lots of clarinet trills. All of that sort of minor improvisation within this pretty fairly rigid structure that's governed by this rhythm section it sounds loose, but in fact it's not. They just kind of have that sound. They kind of have it down, and I don't think it's easy. I think it's probably pretty hard to do, but they make it sound easy. You never are you're never, when you listen to this, think, oh my God, that is impossibly complex. But it is.
No. Well, reasonably complex. I don't know. I mean, it's interestingly, the tune you brought up, The Darker It Gets, co-authored by Paul Williams.
Oh.
So we're making a rainbow connection here, kids that don't remember the 70s.
Paul Williams is a better composer than people give him credit for.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I mean, Rainy Days and Mondays do get me down.
More than that, he wrote some good stuff.
No, yeah.
For those who don't know, Paul Williams is, I guess he was always blonde or white-haired. And pop people might recognize him from, he appeared in the first Smokey and the Bandit movie. And so if you know that film, he's the villain, believe it or not, in the film. Little tiny guy. He did some pop music, and he wrote some good tunes. Is he not still alive? I'm pretty sure he's not dead.
I think he is. Yeah, he's had a presence. He's had a comeback. He had a memoir about the drug haze. He was in the 70s and the 80s. And anyway, had this weird double career.
Yeah, he's been around.
Yeah, so I guess in a way what that illustrates is that in a sense, too, I don't know if you've ever seen The Princess and the Frog, but it's the last hand-drawn Disney film. It was, you know, no CGI, and it was set in New Orleans. And there's that sense that the genre can be kind of pastiche.
Right.
You know, that there's a way that the techniques are kind of after 100 years pretty well known. The feel is known. People can kind of do that. Just as I think that, you know, you get the sense, I think of much of the music on this disc, not necessarily in a negative way, but in general, this kind of music is more of a craft at this point, right? It's a craft you can learn. It's a craft you can master. Not everybody can do it, of course. It takes skill, it takes dedication, but it's kind of a known thing that you can be initiated into because it's been, you know, the rules have been more or less established for, again, about 100 years.
I think it's a little harder to actually, I think this sounds easy, and I don't think it's easy at all. I think I've heard Marsalis talk about this, and I think he's right, that these forms are deceptively simple, but they require a great deal of precision and a fair amount of technique in order to improvise within what are fairly rigid song structures. And improvisations are often these micro improvisations over the ends of lines, around the end of a chorus. And they're recognized forms of improvisation, but they have to fit within. It's more rigid than I think people think, the form. And to do it well is to make it sound easy, to make it sound simple. And I just don't think it's simple. We're so familiar with it that we think it's easy, but I suspect it's not easy to do this well. I mean, just listen to the trumpet soloing over the voice on The Darker It Gets.
Amazing how it changes, it's cold and then it's high. Then I stumble on, oh, that sweet, sweet spot. That hidden place I long to be.
He has to sort of be with the melody, but not totally reproduce the melody. And at the end of the chorus, he'll elevate his sound, get a little bit louder, and then begin to improvise off of the melody. I just think that's trickier than it initially sounds.
As you say, I think in a sense, if nothing else, to play with the kind of looseness but tightness, right? That it's got that kind of rambling groove, but it never goes off the rails. That is, you know, it does take talent, right? You're not everybody can play that way.
I saw the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra years ago in Iowa, and Marsalis wasn't there, but a lot of the name players were people who you will know, Herlin Riley, what's his name, Wessel, Warm Daddy Anderson, you know, yeah, a bunch of players that you'll know. For their encore, they did a couple of New Orleans numbers, and God, they're just so fucking, I remember hearing that thinking, holy shit, this is amazing. I mean, they're just doing, I think they did The Saints Go Marching In, right, which you've just heard a million fucking times.
Yeah.
When you hear players at a high caliber doing that with all the micro improvisations that they bring to bear on that song, I just remember thinking, this is amazing. This is actually really tight, really, really thought out. Not just, you have to know this tradition so well in order to play in it, it seems to me. And maybe I've just been convinced ever since then. Because I remember seeing Marsalis on a documentary, it might have been on that Burns thing, you know, talking about jazz. And I remember hearing Marsalis talk about this, and I remember thinking, he's right. New Orleans Dixieland is deceptively difficult, I think. I remember just from my own experience seeing the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, I think, yeah, okay, I buy that.
I will resist the urge to pontificate about jazz again, but that is a pure block of ideology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you get no argument from me that series is a mess.
With the Preservation, you know, when I saw them back in the 80s, it was not necessarily a powerhouse musical organization at that point, right? Some of these musicians were at the very, end of their viable lifespans, and it was more kind of a museum thing. I think that this album has enough looseness and a sense of fun. In terms of the technique, it's varied. Some are very excellent players. All are fine. But, I mean, it is a little bit looser and maybe at times sloppier than many mainstream jazz releases you're going to hear. You're not coming here to kind of find the guy that's going to out Coltrane. And that last piece is interesting to me. I cannot remember. Somebody from the rock world helped produce this, like some guy from My Morning Jacket.
Yeah, Jim James. I can't stand his voice, but I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
I never listened to that group, but there it was interesting because that last piece is literally like, this is the studio creating and selling you an ambience of old timiness that is largely constructed, right? You know, they get this out of tune piano and they process it and treat it. Doesn't mean the song has no merit.
You're talking about that song I've talked about at the beginning, Dakota, there, Emelina's Lullaby.
Absolutely. Right. Thank you. And yes, there you can just kind of hear a myth in the process of being constructed, which is still enjoyable. I mean, I listen to a lot of studio pop. I don't mind treated instruments, but it is somebody saying, we're not going to show you the real thing, which is one of the problems with this project is, right, we do have recordings of musicians from New Orleans from the Dixieland period. Some of them are kind of hard to listen to, as I bitched about a few weeks ago. But, we've got Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Sevens. We've, so in a sense, if you want to hear The Water from the Spring, it's there. This band's released 20 albums. I had no idea they were quite that prolific.
Jesus.
Yeah, well, I mean, over a very long span of time.
Right.
But yeah, still, I mean, it's not, it's the kind of thing I tend to think of more that a group you might see live, a group you might see in New Orleans. But, as a record that's got its own pleasure, I think this is viable. I enjoy it and I don't spend it a lot. And I kind of thought, oh my God, this is where I can spend some time thinking about and using this record. Not that I hated it when I spun it back when it came out, but just what's the context for this? Because I don't think of this as a jazz release in the way I would think of the next Maria Schneider album or the next Chris Potter album. It's kind of its own thing. What would you say about the jazz content here?
Yeah, you have to, there are some solos here and they're interesting. Some of them are understated. They're low key. There's that song Yellow Moon, which is really kind of a little Valentine for the woodwinds. And there's a nice clarinet solo running throughout that song. So all these guys are good musicians. They play at a pretty high level. But for me, the things that stood out were, of course, the tuba player, not because he's excellent, just because I can't get enough of that sound. And I thought the trumpet player had some just really filthy solos on a handful of the numbers. So, yeah, but no other player jumped out at me as an individual where I said, oh my God, I'd like to hear this guy in his own disc. Not that any of them were anything less than excellent. It's just none of them reached out and grabbed me where I thought, oh, I have to hear this song again. Yellowman's a good example. That clarinet solo is fine. It's good. It fits the context of that song, which is sort of kind of a dirge. It's sort of like a funeral dirge. It's a low key kind of minor key number. And the solo there is terrific, but it's not going to make me forget lots of other clarinetists. It's just good. It's just good. So that's kind of how I feel about the whole album. It's just good. And I think looking at their discography, their next disc also are originals, it looks like. So it'd be interesting to know if that's a direction they're headed in, this sort of in this mode of jazz, but doing original compositions. That's what they're going to do from now. I mean, they already have the We Represent New Orleans Dixieland thing down, so maybe they're going to add more arrows to their quiver.
And at some point, you just can't. There are no living musicians from that era left. Right. So you can't, your band's mission statement can't be, we're letting you hear these links to the past. They're gone. So now with the identity of this group, and it sounds like, they're going to play in this tradition for sure. They're going to keep, again, this is a album that is goes down easy, has a lot of fun rhythms in it, and never ask for, never kind of hurts you either in terms of tonality or structure or challenging lyrics that disturb you. I mean, it's meant to be party music, enjoyable music, fun music. But within that, the new leader's feeling is you've got to bring something a little fresher to the table, because at this point, you know, they've got their own recorded legacy, much less the recorded legacy of the original musicians, and they can't really claim right. anymore that here's history preserved.
It's definitely this genre of music is ensemble music, in that, especially with the rhythm section, everyone kind of has to interlock. You know, they all have to kind of slot into recognized places in the music. Play, like, say if you're a horn player, you're playing the melody, and then you're allowed at the ends of lines or occasionally over the middles of lines to do something. But it's all the improvisations are all small and within a recognized structure. And if you're someone who has a voice of your own, if you're Louis Armstrong, you're gonna need your own band. You're just not going to keep doing this stuff.
Yeah, and of course, Louis, among other things, was accused of kind of destroying the original style of Dixieland yeah. music that was polyphonic and putting undue emphasis on a soloist. So the next album, unless you've got more to say about the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
No, we've said too much about it already.
Yeah. Well, listen, we don't want to break butterflies on the wheel here.
Edit this down. Cut it down to 20 minutes. Whatever we said, like, cut shit out.
Anyway, our next artist does have more of a distinctive voice and certainly an impressive career, Craig Handy. When I heard that name and heard this and saw this was very well reviewed, I didn't know that much about him, so I started looking things up and I realized, well, I've encountered him a lot. It's just rarely as a headliner. So Craig was in the Mingus Big Band for quite a while. He played with Betty Carter, appeared on a couple of her albums, toured with Herbie Hancock, though didn't record with Herbie. Also early in his career, toured with Roy Haynes. His first leader date.
Didn't everyone tour with Roy Haynes at one point?
Roy's age, you just anybody, right? You know, all the guys.
Roy is like played with everyone alive.
That's right.
Every single person
in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band's like, well, my first gig was Roy Haynes. He's like, what the fuck is a tuba player doing here?
He's still alive and still playing, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's still around, right?
He's 117 and he's really good. Anyway, his first. Getting back to Craig Handy. His first leader date was in 1992. So he is now a veteran, and I did listen briefly to Three for All Plus One on Arabesque, and that's a good jazz trio album. If you'd like to read more about him, there's a pretty good profile from a few years ago on All About Jazz. And one of his interesting comments in that interview, which is several pages, internet pages long, whatever that would mean, is that he's a natural ballad player. He feels like he's never had any problem playing slow. The fast stuff is not necessarily as natural to him. He had to work harder at that. He was also for a while in the Cookers.
That's right. I have one of their CDs. I think
yeah.
he's on
so
it.
That was a group that I caught at the Jazz Kitchen a year or two back. And at that time, Billy Harper was there, but Craig was not.
Yes.
But I think they were co-evil in the band for a little while. But yeah, Craig's on several of their albums. And he's, in very many ways, a Cookers-level artist, right? Very good, very great jazz cred. Some charisma, but not somebody who is a headliner, has a huge discography, or is kind of a super well-known name in that top tier of jazz musicians that most of the fans at least have heard of. So anyway, for this project, he had the idea of combining New Orleans rhythms and approaches with Jimmy Smith's repertoire, put together this project called Second Line Smith. And that's another joint from, 2014, so a year after that's it. So thoughts about Second Line Smith and Craig Handy?
I like this quite a bit. I think I like it better than the Preservation Hall Jazz Band album, in part because there is more jazz content here. Craig Handy is, I guess I've read somewhere that he sees himself as like Turrentine. I hear a little Coltrane, early Coltrane here in his playing. He's a good player. I like a lot of his solos here. They swing. It's interesting to hear him say that he's uncomfortable or finds playing fast challenging, because it sure doesn't
right.
seem
Maybe
like
he's
it.
He's had to work at it harder, but he's pretty confident, yeah.
Yeah, on this date. Again, if you're playing with this sort of rhythm section that has these New Orleans kind of sounds, right? So oftentimes, right, we get, I don't know if it's a tuba or a sousaphone here, we get something here instead of a bass. And I guess I didn't even mention this in the Preservation Hall Jazz album, but there is a drum kit, but it's very heavy on the kick bass, right? I mean, that's sort of what's driving a lot of the rhythms here. so that the rhythmic component is just very locked in groove on most of these songs. And he's real comfortable, it seems to me, improvising at speed over that stuff. I kind of like him here a lot, and I think this might have the most pure jazz content of anything we're talking about. I like a great deal when Wynton Marsalis guests on this. He appears on Mojo Workin'. A lot of mute work, and whenever Wynton dirties up his style, it's always a good day. And I don't know, maybe it's the New Orleans content that got him going on this particular number. I'm not sure what it was, but he's in very good form on that song, and I'd like to hear him play like this more often, just sort of engaged, and he seems like really into this. And I like the growls, I like the trills, I love the mute work. That was one of the highlights of this album for me, is when he appears. I just thought, wow, this is him giving a shit. Not that he doesn't give a shit at other times, but he can be so polished that it feels like he doesn't give a shit. And this feels dirtier in some way. I also just like the general feel of this album. I often am not real happy with the sound of organ and guitar together. It sounds kind of fruity, but here, that's kind of the whole point. It's kind of fruity, peppy party. And it kind of captures Jimmy Smith's mojo. It kind of captures the sort of freewheeling party-ness of a Jimmy Smith joint with maybe a little more edge than some of... So Jimmy Smith, we've talked about him before, but he's, to me, in my mind, sort of the classic three-star jazz man. You could just rely on him to churn out sort of soul improvisation stuff, and he recorded a lot, album after album. Like, he's just a reliable three-star guy. And every now and again, it seems like he really gives a shit, and he plays better. There's a handful of his recordings that I'm like, ah, wow, Jimmy's in good form. But the rest of the time, it's like, okay, he could do this stuff in his sleep. And so sometimes on Jimmy Smith's recordings, it feels like, as good as they are, he's cashing a check. He's doing what he does. He's really good at it, and he's doing it. And this feels a little more urgent all the way through. So it sort of captured the Jimmy Smith louche party soul R&B atmosphere, but they also feels more urgent and heartfelt than a lot of Jimmy Smith's own recordings, which I like. So in general, this appealed to me. I thought this was pretty good, and I like Handy's playing here a lot. I think he does well at speed. I don't know. Did you like this disc? I hope you liked it.
I did. I think that one advantage of merging Smith's repertoire with the New Orleans tradition is that Smith is a bebop maximalist who never met a note. Yes. He didn't want to play 17 times in one bar. And so exactly. Here, the tradition of New Orleans is a more direct, earthy kind of music, and it kind of trims down the fat from Jimmy style and kind of gives you the essence. And yeah, I read a review somewhere, I guess, that Handy considered himself coming out of the Coltrane tradition, but he said, as I've gotten older, I've listened more and more to Stanley Turrentine. And he's obviously a great model for somebody who had real content and a real strong personality, but played, you know, more music that appealed more to the common guy on the street. And I've not listened to Turrentine's, you know, 70s forward stuff, but I do like his stuff on Blue Note quite a bit. He's just, you know, got a lot of personality and grit, and I enjoy it. And yeah, Handy here, I think, shows himself to be a fine soloist. He's not trying to kind of just dazzle you with pyrotechnics, but he clearly plays the horn very well. It is a concept that kind of works well. I mean, if you're going to do a high concept album, at least pick one where the concept is gels and makes artistic sense. I think it does. You know, D.D. Bridgewater on Sunny Side of the Street.
I'm not a, this is sacrilege for a lot of people, but I've just never been a fan of D.D. Bridgewater. She's a fine singer, but man, I just feel like she's got an outsized reputation. I've just never, there's a couple of singers who I don't get into for differing reasons, and she's one of them. She can sing, and she's an icon for some people, and I just never have liked her very much. Someday we'll have to do a Nina Simone episode where I can bitch about how much I hate Nina Simone as well. You know, and again, another icon, you know, they're both highly regarded singers, and I just don't feel any affection for. Yeah, she's okay. Yeah. I wouldn't miss her if she wasn't there.
Right, and it's one of a couple vocal features.
Sorry, all the D.D. Bridgewater fans out there.
I think I talked a few years ago when I caught a superstar group that she was headlining in Indianapolis and that had Chris Potter and just a mix of fine jazz musicians. And it was very much, I mean, she is a crowd pleaser. She's an extrovert, maybe a bit of a showboater, very talented, but not somebody going to turn to for the most distilled sincerity as much as kind of a great entertainer. And I think, that's fine. I mean, this is, again, it's one of the things that these groups are dealing with is how do you try to broaden jazz's appeal to a larger audience? One common technique is to get somebody singing because most people find it easier to associate with or get a singing act rather than one that's purely instrumental, right? You've got language there to reach you. And so Craig does it a couple times, but this is, I don't think of this as an album that's dominated by the vocals. I think overall this is a good record. Again, I don't know. I like it a lot. I think with a couple of vocal features, I don't know whether I put it into a regular mix of jazz records. I don't know whether I'd listen to it as often as, I don't know, just, you know, a Kenny Burrell album or something. Whatever you want to compare it to. But I think it largely succeeds very well. And some of the time, it fits in that mold. I mean, there's certain fun time jazz records like, you know, Bluesy Burrell or whatever that, or Midnight Blue by Burrell, for two examples, that I love putting on, and it's a combination of kind of party music and jazz. And I'd agree, this is the one where you get the most improvisation. I think he's probably the single strongest improviser of tonight's program. But, you know, somebody who has tried, you know, he's released trio albums and whatnot, and of course he's been in a lot of various relatively hardcore jazz ensembles, but he's decided, you know, he was trying to come up with something that may be a little bit more populist, both, you know, no means sell out or just a watering down of what he's doing, and found this project. So I enjoyed it. I think it was probably my favorite. Okay, so now we're going to move over to the oddest selection here, the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. And I was kind of poking around eMusic a year or so ago looking for another piece to slot into this program that I figured was going to come sooner or later, and ran across them. This is kind of an EP they released. They used to self-release albums on just like CDRs, and apparently for a long time, all of them were called the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble and could only be identified by the color. Have you read anything about this group? Do you know about their weird back history?
I just read a little bit this morning, and it is weird. Tell the fans.
So this group was formed in 2004 by eight sons of jazz trumpeter Phil Coran. Phil had...
Are they by different wives or women?
I'm assuming, because the names aren't all the same. Phil had 23 children. I'm not kidding. With different women, which you're hoping, because otherwise it'd be some kind of human rights violation. You know, honey,
holy
not tonight,
shit.
Not ever.
23
kids.
I guess the tails were wiggling. I guess he had high motility on those. God damn, 23.
Well, the tragedy is he wanted to make his own symphony orchestra and he just ran out of energy. I need another French horn.
That is astonishing. Wow, 23. So there could be other members of this ensemble in the future if they take up a horn.
I told my wife, it's like, it's eight kids of this one guy and a drummer. She's like, what? He's got 23 kids. Couldn't one of them learn the fucking drums? I'm like, no, I think.
Right.
I don't know generationally or anything else. And apparently it was one of these things. He used to play for Sun Ra, and I've talked about Ra's kind of band leader, cult leader. And apparently, this guy, it was like you get up early in the morning before school and you play your trumpet exercises before going off, you know, at age 6 or something. You know, you can pick up a trumpet, now blow it. Wow. This is there's probably a documentary in here somewhere. Yeah, I mean, this music, there is, again, tuba. The beats, I'd say, are the, you know, most connected to hip-hop, probably. Well, Red Barat also has some connections there. But this is, it's a little harder to pigeonhole as to what they're up to here. I really think Hypnotic Joints is a pretty good name for this project. I did listen to a couple earlier things, and especially the live album, I was able to listen to a little more of a rough edge and maybe a little bit more of what I consider kind of a jazz energy. Here, this is, I don't know, what would you call this?
Highly produced, extremely technically proficient. I don't know what you call it. It puts me in mind of a little bit, given the intricacy of these arrangements, it puts me in mind of Prague. Because, I mean, take, for example, the opening song, 100, right? So you've got this drum beat rhythm thing, and there's this tuba playing, you know, the bass role. But it's all the guys on their horns. I take it trumpets and trombones and I'm not sure what else. And they're playing these really intricate sort of eighth note interlocking patterns. And then there'll be free space for someone to solo. I hear a saxophone here and so forth. But this piece that they're playing, it's just bup, bup, bup. But, you know, there's sort of these interlocking little short bursts. And God, that's got to be hard to do. How many takes did this take? And in addition to the sort of but interlocking brass playing, we get these sort of really melodic, sweet lines where they sort of swell and play together over the rhythm. It is hypnotic. The bup, 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 bup stuff is hypnotic. And then when they sort of go into these swelling brass lines over the rhythm, again, this is sort of trancey. And I think it's awfully difficult. There's no bobbles here. I mean, it's really tight. So it reminds me of Prague to a certain extent. I know that's not quite the right register, but just in terms of not fucking up, this has got to be impossibly difficult to play. And maybe it helps that their dad drilled them at 6 in the morning every day to do this stuff, because Jesus, they're tight. And the songs are a little hard to tell apart, in part because they often take this mode, right? Can you just describe the instrumentation here besides drummer and tuba player? What are they playing? How many do we have on what?
Wikipedia tells me there are 4 trumpeters and a couple trombones and baritone horn and then bass and guitar. So that's what they show. Yeah, 4 trumpets, 2 trombones, 1 baritone horn, and then a bass and guitar.
Because I'm certain I hear saxophone.
There may have been guests. And again, the documentation for this group is a little hard to track down. That's a core ensemble. You know, at some point, Daddy don't make no saxophone players. They had to bring somebody in, or maybe it's one of the many siblings who guessed it. I just don't know. But yeah, I would also relate this a little bit to minimalism, the kind of, you know, cellular construction almost. I did find that this music, you've got a technique which I often borrow of putting things in a playlist and putting it on random. And boy, never was that idea better served than this episode. It really helped for me to break up the various, you know, albums and hear them in bits and pieces rather than as a whole, especially for this one and to some degree for the next one coming up. And that this particular, really, it's not quite LP length album, is definitely looking at a couple ideas very closely and pursuing them, you know, to some degree. There's kind of sameness about it. It's mellow and trancy in some ways, but also if I listen to too much of it in a row, I start to get a bad headache. I'm asking for something else to happen. Maybe for just some break in the sound. There's not a lot of space or air here because there's always some kind of rotating pattern, I guess I'd say. You know, they're not, this is the opposite of a thread gill or a branch.
That and also they're recorded. It's really dry. This is not a wet sound. It sounds very, very close to the mic. Lots of wind screens over the mics. It's very, very close. I love it. I actually like the way this is recorded a lot. I like the sound. But yeah, I read somewhere that they're probably best known for. I guess it's a cover of War that made it onto one of the Hunger Games film's soundtracks. Oh. And I'd like to hear that. I got a feeling they blow the roof off the dump. There's no question these guys are really, really good. But this is very subdued. And like you said, it's well-named. Hypnotic Joints, man. That's what it is. This is trancey, spacey, but intricate. You could definitely lose yourself in this. If you just were listening to this, you could really zone in and you could either zone in or zone out. You could easily let this become background music. But then if you paid close attention, you'd be like, wow, that's a lot of eighth notes. That's a lot of eighth notes played in unison and harmony in a row together. Right. That's pretty tight.
The discipline not being so much the technical challenge as just the concentration required not to get bored and mess up in a ride. It's just that some of those patterns, it's just like, how do you do it when you're doing it for the 15th or 20th time? It's not music in this incarnation on this particular recording of the free interplay of kind of individual voices, right? It's not a great jazz group reacting to one another and pushing each other and surprising each other. It's a little more regimented than that. Yeah, this is, for me, the hardest album to kind of make sense of aesthetically. It's fascinating and I like it on a mixer. I don't like it 30 minutes in a row. I just think there's not enough nutrients in it for me. There's not enough variety, but as a interlude amongst the other stuff, it works really, really well. And it's super distinctive and it is different. I mean, I don't know that I've heard instrumental music quite like it before, and that is pretty impressive, right? I mean, because, you know, it's
yeah.
In a sense, I mean, you know, the whole mission statement of Craig Handy and Second Line Smith is like contained in the title. He knows he's mixing known things, just as the New Orleans Preservation Hall Jazz Band is presenting a known tradition that's, again, as I've said many times, 100 years old. So this is a hybrid kind of thing that I don't know that I can pigeonhole. In a way, I think it would have been easier for me anyway to have understood and processed and talked a little bit about Black Flower, and that they've got a little more overt improvisation in their sound, and they're a little bit more tied into the kind of jam band scene, where this is not a jam band. You know, this is not a psychedelia exactly. I mean, it has psychedelic effects, but it's more hypnosis. You know, it's very kind of disciplined.
Well, I got a feeling if you saw them live, if they could reproduce this sound live. So for example, like Oh My God, right? That song, it basically has two elements. It's just got, you know, the trumpets going this sort of bup, 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 and there's little harmonies that they're playing. But that's the riff. That's all they're playing for the whole length of this, whatever it is, song, right? Or 3-minute song. And then over that, you've got this sort of swelling harmonic lines of trumpet and trombones sort of blah-dee-dee-da over that, right? And I bet live that is just enthralling. I bet seeing these guys do this shit live, I mean, because this is a micro example of building and sustaining tension. It's only 3 minutes long. I would love to see these guys live. I bet they would have you out of your seat and just this kind of stuff really hits a place for me. I really like this a lot, and it makes me want to know more about this band, and I'd love to see them live. I got a feeling seeing this live would just be enthralling, just completely absorbing. There's nothing dull about this for me. I mean, I really like this, and I found it hard not to pay attention. So when the stuff came
That's interesting.
Up, I would get drawn into it. And if I was working on something, I would really have to sort of, you know, force it down in the back of my mind in order to keep working on something else. Because I'm drawn into the minor variations that they're playing, that they're riffing on over and over again. I find it absorbing. And like I said, I just think live, this is going to be something else. Recently I've been listening to the greatest hits of Chicago, and the early Chicago stuff featured that incredible section of horn players, and they played a lot of these sort of swelling interlocking lines, and these guys are like that group, only minimalist and tighter and more sort of harmonically locked in together, and this just scratches an itch for me. I really like this stuff, so I'd like to see them live really badly.
Yeah, and on top of that, they're sexy young men, and sometimes they play without their shirts on, so
there's that too.
Can't go wrong. Yeah, I don't know. I think at times I wanted a little more development or variation, and that may have been me missing the minutia because I wasn't focusing enough. And then the repetition was starting to bother my reptile brain a bit. But it is. It's definitely distinctive. They are rougher edge. The one live recording I heard, it was not quite this polished perfection. And of course, it's a little bit earlier. And again, this is a band that really has not been around that long. They've put out a lot of music. Well, 14 years, I guess, is no small thing. It's a long time for a rock band, less so for a jazz ensemble. So we don't know where they're going to end up. But a fascinating document. I think all these groups, in a sense, this is the kind of music that almost makes more sense live, in that it is, to some degree, music for use. It's trying to make a more direct connection with an audience. It's not necessarily something you have to spend hours breaking down, thinking about, analyzing, though this probably is the most of the, most opaque in that sense of the records. Most of these are pretty straightforward. If we're done with Hypnotic Brass, we can move on to a group that's definitely going to make us think hard about what it means to be Shrug Each Eye. Is that like a thing? Is it a drink? Is it a dance?
It's gotta be Shruggy G. It can't be Jai. It's got to be Shruggy G.
You're right. I said Shruggy G before.
There's no way. Dumadum mast kalandar, Hali sha paas kalandar, Dumadum mast kalandar, Hali ta pehla number, Dumadum mast kalandar, 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 Dumadum, Dumadum, Dumadum mast kalandar, Dumadum, Dumadum, Dumadum mast kalandar, Dumadum, Dumadum, Dumadum mast kalandar. If it's Shruggy Jai, they're idiots. Shruggy G is a billion times more marketable than Shruggy Jai.
I must be right, because in a sense, yeah, they're.
In fact, they say Shruggy G.
There we go.
So
okay.
They say it.
I agree with you. I think you're right. In a sense, there's some kind of imaginary Indian jazz rap artist. This is a group that's been around from 2000, formed in 2008.
In the jazz mecca of 12 fans?
Well, it's Brooklyn, isn't it?
Of course.
what other place you're going to combine kind of New Orleans parade music with Indian music with rap. And this is their second album. Their third album came out in 2017. So this is a group that is not pushing out quite as much product as the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. Certainly not as much as Preservation Hall Jazz Band, though probably year by year they might have the same productive rate. I saw them live at the Jazz Kitchen a couple years ago. They were a lot of fun. The leader plays this Indian drum that you talked about before. What's the name of it?
Not a clue.
I thought you did. Maybe you're talking about the style of music.
Tabla? I have no idea. I don't know.
No, good heavens. What's the style of music? You were saying it's Bhangra or something?
Bhangra. Oh, Bhangra. Bhangra. Okay. Bhangra. 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 And I think I mistakenly said Bengali before. I think. I hope I didn't. If I did, edit it out. It's associated with Punjab. So I'm screwing up my regions of India.
Yeah, I just like the chicken tikka masala, and which is completely authentic to there.
Well, this would matter to a Bengali or Punjabi, so it would be like calling California fried chicken, and the colonel would spin in his grave. So
we're out of our depth here. Anyway, the drummer is a leader. He's playing a two-sided Indian drum with a very distinctive rhythm. He has boundless energy. He probably already has more than 23 children. I'm not sure, but I would not be surprised. And yeah, it's a kind of a brass band with drums and bass, or rather a tuba. It's very much in the party genre. This is the one that I think is probably most explicit about its connection to hip hop, and that we have some sort of rap-esque vocals on it occasionally. There are lots of encouragements to party and enjoy yourself, even on the studio effort. There's a lot of rollicking rhythm. a lot of energy. And I, you know, it's a very distinctive sound. I think probably by the end of it, I heard maybe a little bit more of it than I wanted to, but certainly if you got it in short bursts, it's a lot of fun. And they are, I can attest, a lot of fun live. So what do you think of Shruggy G?
Well, I love this to death. This is far and away my favorite this week. You introduced me to this, I think, it's been a couple of years now. And I remember I play music on headphones before classes, and I was rocking out to Shruggy G, you know, 10 minutes before class one day. I guess this was either a year ago or a year and a half ago. And my students, it's 10 minutes before class, like, what are you listening to? Because I'm just really kind of in my own little headspace. And I'm like, oh? And so I put it on, and they're like, what the fuck is that? They were like, this is awesome. And I'm like, isn't it? It is awesome. It's just, God, talk about hip-shaking, rump-grooving music. I love this to death. I can't get enough of this. I have an almost infinite capacity for enjoying this. It never gets old. And when you propose listening to it again, it had gone out of the rotation for me. I kind of have a limit on how often I'll listen to something, and then I put it in storage and don't listen to it for a while. And when you suggested it, I'm like, oh, yeah, this again. I can't wait. I love this. I think it's fantastic. I play it before classes. Students invariably ask me about it. They think it's great. And that tells you something when you're playing a disc with oftentimes not English words, and your students hear it and they're like, what is that? You know, they're doing the sound check thing to figure out, you know, they've got their cell phones out trying to identify it. Yeah, this is total party music, and I love everything about it. I love the beats. I love the call and response stuff when they do that. I love the horns. Love the tuba. There's nothing about this that I don't like. This, I can't analyze it. It just scratches every part of my reptile brain, and I'm super pleased when any of these songs come on. They just work for me. I do think there's some jazz content here, or I don't know if you want to call it jazz content. There's improvisation, right? Anytime you get this kind of rhythmic interlocking, lots of drums, lots of percussion here. Anytime you get that stuff, it's a great bedrock for solos, right? So like on the title cut, I take it, it's a soprano saxophone that has an extended workout over that, and it's hot. There's a couple of these, several of these moments on the album, and whether you want to call that jazz content or not, it is improvisation. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is these beats are not especially fast. These songs metronomically, whatever that word is, they're not, you know, boom, 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 boom. It's not like that. They're at this sort of slower speed, boom, 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 and then, you know, just incredible percussion over these moderated beats with all that lavish horn playing over it. I love this. I'm probably not going to be able to analyze it. I just think it's fantastic. And I take it you're going to have to be the critical one here, because I just don't have a bad thing to say about this. I love it completely, and I've listened to anything by them. This is the only album of theirs I know of, and if there were others, I'd get them. Or, you know, whenever I see them, I'll get them, because this is awesome. Just awesome.
I just found out, I did not realize this. Apparently, the leader here, Sonny Jane, and he plays a drum called the DHOL. It is the
Dole. Yeah.
It's the Simpsons, if you say it Dole. Like Homer Simpson. I don't know how you pronounce it. anyways, it's a two-sided drum. And yeah, as you're right, the tempos of these songs are not lickety-split, but the percussive elaborations he plays over them are very complex. And, you know, if you've ever heard anything from Bollywood, most of the party numbers have this kind of rhythm in them, or a variant of this rhythm.
You could totally see an ensemble dance over the closing credits to any one of these songs.
Absolutely. And very much that kind of. And it's, you know, this a mood world that just seems a little specific to the Indians. I don't know that we've got quite the equivalent. I mean, I guess New Orleans music would be one, but it's just got quite its own thing there.
Yeah.
Anyway, apparently he led a group, I'd never realized this, with Vijay Iyer and Rudrish
Oh my goodness.
Tapa? Both in it? You know, holy crap.
Rudresh Mahantapa, Vijay Iyer. I think it's Iyer. Okay. Vijay Iyer. Anyway. Yeah. The two most famous Indian jazz musicians
That would have been curious. The Sunny Jane Collective. That must have been interesting.
I'll bet.
Anyway, but this is very much very likable, outgoing, kind of party-based music. I would agree. Yeah, there's some improvisation in this. I feel like it's more prominent than in the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble album. I certainly noticed it more. But again, it's with all these projects, with, I think, Handy being the outlier, and that you hear more from him, and there's more soloists. You know, largely, this is not, and this is one thing that, you know, these party albums kind of teach you about jazz, is that for the general public, they tend to get bored or their attention wanders when somebody stands up and plays a solo for 2 or 3 minutes. For the jazz fan, that tends to be much of the heart of what you're looking for, but most people find it kind of off-putting or just hard to follow or not very interesting. And mostly these groups, even if there's a solo going on, the rhythm, I mean, this, I'd say the mixer here, instead of more cowbell, it's kept more dial. You know, the drum is always kind of front and center to every track. He is a leader, but you know, if someone's soloing, he's not necessarily the louder volume than the drums. It's not mixed that way. It's not meant to highlight that. That's not kind of the purpose of the music. It's more kind of an elaboration or an addition to it or a decoration, but the music's about the rhythm. Yeah, I enjoy this record. As I said, I don't know that I want to hear their music for 50 minutes in a row. You know, they don't do ballads, right? They don't really do.
No. They do a cover here. They do a cover of Gurdas Mann's Apna, whatever it is, Apna something Hove, which is a very famous Punjabi number. But that's,
And another group that there's not a lot of space. Right. I mean, it's the sound field is full pretty much the whole time, which, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that you lose certain textural possibilities when you have pretty much everybody playing pretty much all the time. At the same time, you never have a moment of kind of drift or introspection. So if you're trying to create energy, you're never in danger of diffusing that. And you're never really asking your audience to say, okay, I'm going to sit down and think about this and vibe to it. It's more, you know, shake your ass to this, get involved with it, enjoy it. But we're not asking you to kind of give the attention of your head rather than your butt to this music fully. We're not trying to do that. You know, we're not trying to stress you or challenge you. We're trying to entertain you. And on those terms, it works really well. And again, I think it works even better in a club.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I'm just listening to Turned Way Down in the background on my headphones and being reminded again how amazing the trombone player is on this, or one of them. My God, just unbelievable player. And whoever's playing the clarinet here also, they just stand out. But this is an ensemble affair. I don't have anything bad to say about this. This is my favorite CD that we've talked about in a real long time. I just want everyone to go get it. I think they're awesome. This is infectious fun. And if you're not into jazz and you're into something more upbeat and happy, this is your disc. You cannot listen to this and be bored.
Yeah, it looks like they released, you know, 2009, their debut, and then Shruggies from 2013. And the next two albums are 2015 and 2017. So presumably next year we'll have another one. So, you know, they're on a reasonable release schedule at this moment. And I don't know whether there is some kind of development or difference between the albums or whether they're much of a muchness. Yeah, I love it. I mean, it is a very distinctive, very uplifting sound. You can't mistake them. It's this weird mix of, you know, kind of Bollywood, New Orleans, and jazz with a little rap, right? There's some of that too.
Yeah. There's some hip hop beats. Yeah,
absolutely.
In here,
and a little kind of low intensity, humorous rapping. You know, they're not trying to show they've got the best flow in New York, but just, you know, kind of having fun with it. But as I said, I mean, it is a album of a full sound field and a lot of energy on every track. And so it kind of depends on what mood you're on. If you're wanting to have a party, if you're wanting to clean the house, great. I don't know, again, that's something I want to sit down and listen to just on its own for 50 minutes in a row.
This is a hard one to work over, because when I hear it, I'm like, yeah.
There you go.
Here I'm trying to grade essays, and I'm like, can we get back to hypnotic breaths on someone so I can get
there
some work done?
You tape a duster to your butt for this one, and pretty soon the house is clean. Everything's fine. And the neighbors are wondering what the fuck's going on. All right. Well, anyway, party jazz is its own thing. And it's an ongoing project that often I think it's guys or gals with jazz chops. And mostly these are guys. I don't know, aside from Dee Dee, that we have really much in the way of women participating in this, for better or for worse.
Well, I think Red Barat has several female members.
I'm sorry. Okay. I don't remember them from the concert.
I think there's at least, I was looking up and there's at least a couple. I don't know if that's still true, because I have a feeling any Brooklyn-based ensemble is going to have fluid membership.
Sure. And
but
I
think
no
there are some women involved.
I can't imagine. I mean, these guys are not brotastic or something. I mean, it's party music,
right,
but it's not in that sense. And of course, I think increasingly in the last generation, you just got so many excellent women instrumentalists, and just I think those barriers to kind of girls play flutes and boys play trumpet are kind of breaking down pretty considerably. And as much as anybody plays anything, which is increasingly the exception of the rule now, that America's destroyed its music education program so thoroughly. So, yeah, I mean, no problem. But for the most part, I don't remember. Now, I could have just forgotten. But I don't remember seeing any women in that ensemble. But again, I might be wrong about that. There might have been one. Anyway, good stuff. Definitely worth hearing. And it kind of brings to the problem, you know, what do you do if you've come from a jazz background, but you've decided you aren't going to be the next Chris Potter and you'd like to reach a larger audience? How do you use that skill set to kind of reach out to people? Or maybe just, you know, you'd like to entertain people. That's what you're after. You don't necessarily want them to, you know, look in the dark places of their soul. You want them to have a good time. Okay, any pop matters on your mind?
Yeah, I'm going to take us on a little journey here.
Journey,
so,
I can't wait.
I recently had,
what's your favorite journey track?
Well, I just sort of wandered around a little bit on some stuff. So I belong to a music trading thing, and so I had to re-listen to something recently before I let it go. I traded it out, which was Led Zeppelin's 3-disc set, How the West Was Won. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it, but I've never heard it.
So it's Jimmy Page found this in the archives, I guess, and it's live recordings of them in California in, I think, Long Beach in 1972. And it's just a fascinating set of music because it shows all the things that were good about them and all the things that were bad all in one neat, tiny little package. So the first CD is the longest song we get here is a 9-minute treatment of Stairway to Heaven, which is, well, appropriate because it's a 9-minute song, right? But it's all the songs you'd want to hear them play: Immigrant Song, Black Dog, Over the Hills Far and Away, Since I've Been Loving You, right? And they fucking come on like the songs are around 5 minutes each, most of them, and they're just amazing. This was, I think, Led Zeppelin at their very best, right? It's a tight set and everyone is on form. You can hear why Robert Plant is in some ways like an ideal lead singer for a rock band, because he's got extraordinary range and a great deal of charisma and control. And Page is relatively restrained. He's actually working with the other two instrumentalists in the band. And you hear them do, you know, especially on something like Since I've Been Loving You. I mean, my God, they're just a great blues band. I mean, they're a great blues band. They're so fucking good. And the interplay between the instrumentalists on the fast numbers, right? The Immigrant Song, it's just fucking epic. It's just a great, great opener. So that's awesome. And then comes discs 2 and 3. And there's a couple of 3 20-minute songs here.
Oh boy.
One is a 25-minute version of Dazed and Confused. Dazed and Confused doesn't need to be 10 minutes long, much less 25 fucking minutes long. There's long stretches of Page masturbating on the guitar, and it's not masturbating at speed. I mean, he's just fucking noodling, and everyone has gone out for a coffee. And then it sort of builds and unbuilds, but it's, I could see how at the auditorium, if you're really high, this is awesome. But listening to it now, you think this is about 20 minutes too long. There are some passages. I mean, I wondered, you know, I remember I hadn't listened to it in a while. So when I re-listened to it, I was like, oh, fuck, 25 minutes. What does Plant do for all of this? Right. Because he's, you know, they do the opening and then he goes away for a while. But then he comes back and he and Paige are doing this sort of, you know, interplay with vocal interplay with the guitar. And it might have been interesting to them, but it couldn't have been interesting to anyone else who didn't have massive THC content befuddling their brains. And maybe the nadir is Moby Dick, a song that I'm not real familiar with from their catalog. But it's a 20-minute song, which is an 18-minute drum solo.
Oh, my God.
And it's not an 18-minute rapid drum solo. It's like Bonham's like, let me explore all the parts of my kit. You know, like, let me look underneath the cymbal. What's that? Is there a dust bunny there? I mean, it's just like, really, really? This is just so self-indulgent. It's the kind of thing that only a band with egos the size of, well, Zeppelin's could wish to inflict on an audience. And the only way the audience would put up with it is because they're stoned. It's just horrible. You're just like, what the fuck? It's when these guys are at their best, you're like, holy shit, my God. This version of Stairway to Heaven is fantastic. It's really good. And so that led me to look up on YouTube later performances of Stairway to Heaven, because I was curious, what was it like when they got back together again 20 years later or 15 years later? So that led me to I don't know if you've ever seen it, the incredibly unfortunate Led Zeppelin outing at Band Aid. Remember Band Aid? It happened when we were
vaguely,
I guess,
yeah,
college. Yeah, I mean, we didn't watch it, but it was a big deal at the time. And there were concerts being played at the same time in Philadelphia and at Wembley Stadium in London. And I Googled the Stairway to Heaven live outtake. So they performed it there, and I watched it, and I'm like, is it me or is this really bad? I mean, not like they're having a bad night, but like, this is really, really horribly, something's gone terribly wrong. I mean, so just to describe to you what's gone terribly wrong, of course, Bonham is dead at this point, right? So they have two drummers for the song. One is a guy named Tony Thompson. I don't know him. The other is Phil Collins, who you can bitch and moan about Phil Collins all you want, but he was a drummer for a prog rock band. So he has some bona fides here, right? And when they show the speeded up sections of it, first of all, Paige is not paying any attention to anyone else. He doesn't give a fuck what's going on. Paige is just masturbating on the guitar. Like, he's playing his version of the solo and he's not listening to anything. And I think he's out of tune with respect to the other members of the band. He's definitely out of time. Like, they are not even playing the same fucking song. That's not a song that requires two drummers. It requires one drummer who knows where we are in the song. And I don't think either one of them knew where they were. And supposedly, then I started reading about Band Aid performances, and this is listed as one of the five worst Band Aid performances.
Okay.
Near the top was Paul McCartney, who got like two-thirds of the way through Let It Be, not realizing his microphone wasn't on, so the audience didn't know what he was doing. They could hear music, but they couldn't hear him. Like, no one could hear him, so he's just, look like he's lip syncing, you know, but there's no sound.
Turn the mic on.
Yeah, this is, supposedly Phil Collins was so disgusted, he almost walked off the bandstand mid-set because he couldn't figure out what the fuck was going on. And if you watch the video, it's just uncanny. So there's like Paige, who's not looking at or paying attention to anyone. Like, he does not care. It's like, I have 50,000 people watching me. This is awesome, right? Like, he's totally not tuned in. Robert Plant, he's like playing tambourine and he just looks happy to be there. Like, he just looks like, I haven't been relevant for 10 years. Wow. So this is what it feels like to be in front of 50,000 people. And he's got this beatific smile on his face. He's just happy. He's playing his tambourine and it's like nothing is actually, it's like he's not connected. He's like floating above the events. And they keep going over to the drummers who like are looking at each other and looking at other members like, what the fuck are we doing? What's happening?
Oh, it is fuck.
It's just an amazing clusterfuck. It's definitely worth watching just to see a bunch of people engaged in the same act, but none of them actually doing it at the same time or apparently even in the same key. It's just, it's unbelievable. And of course, the audience are like, it's Led Zeppelin.
So did you watch Dolly Parton's version?
No, I didn't see
it. Oh, it's so good. I'm pretty sure that was what I looked up. I can't go to YouTube here. I think they got it blocked. But anyway, it's a recall, unless I'm just hallucinating this. She does some classic rock song. It kicks ass.
It's famous. It's famous. So she's got a version that's actually quite good.
It is. Yeah, it's awesome. Go, oh, sing me to sleep. None of our lullabies of leaves. La 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 la. Well, my one entry slots nicely into your concerns because I've been listening to Black Coffee, a 2017 release by Beth Hart and John Bonamassa. And it's Joe Bonamassa. And I saw this album in a record store I was in. It's got a very distinctive cover art. Bonamassa is kind of a stripped down version. He's like a combination of blues guitar and Jimmy Page, but kind of stripped down to the vulgar and basic essence of what works in those genres. And he peddles that, and he effects peddles that. Wow. It's kind of meat and potatoes, hot guitar playing. And I mean, hot, overdriven, screaming guitar kind of stuff. And then Beth Hart is like Robert Plant, but much tougher. You know? It's like, if I had to get a fight with one of them in their prime, I'm going to go for Bob every time. Not because I'm not intimidated by Bob, but Beth, I know, can whip my ass. She sounds a lot like Robert Plant. And yeah, there is no 11 that she doesn't want to turn to 12. And so the whole thing is like 40 minutes of just a pile driver of, you know, blues and soul of the white variety and kind of Hendrix-esque guitar just cranked and horns backing. And, you know, it's like a bulldozer. It's kind of fun.
Would this fall into what we used to call cock rock, except that Beth Hart, well, maybe she has a bigger cock than you do, but Beth Hart is the front person.
Yes. Well, but it's not. See, I think of cock rock as something that often gets caught up, and it's, you know, like a Jimmy Page when he's masturbating too much and gets a little lost in its own swagger, where this is a very focused, I mean, yeah, the solos are classic cock rock to some degree, but it is it's machine tooled. It knows exactly what it's trying to do. It's disciplined, even though it's sounding undisciplined all the time. And it's just, it's a party album. And I was trying to turn you on to, at some point you must listen to, if nothing else, their cover of Lullaby of the Leaves, of all the things I never expected. And it, yeah, you have to call him, and he's not coming, because he's like, no, I'm scared. I don't know. So first she sings a verse to the song, which I don't think I've ever heard. In other words, a lot of songs have verses that are completely different melodic harmonic content to what we now think of the verse and chorus as really, in technical terms, was the chorus back in the day. And so, you know, I know this tune mainly from like the Jerry Mulligan Quartet. This is very different. So yeah, she sings it super earthy, blue soul mama, Robert Plant hybrid, just emoting to the skies. And then halfway through this like 7-minute song, she hands it over to Joe and it becomes a Led Zeppelin song. I mean, it's literally the Bonham beat. And Joe just blues soloing, freaking out for like 3 minutes straight over what is a stripped down minor progression loosely based on Lullaby of the Leaves. It's amazing. It's incredibly vulgar, but I love it. But where they come up with that? It's like, okay, we're going to do, you know, this Ann Peebles song, and we're going to do, you know, this other blues tune, and then we're going to do Lullaby of the Leaves? What? I can't fathom how that got into the song stack. I'm glad it did. So yeah, this is definitely worth hearing, but wow. If you're looking for nuance, no, That's something French people like. I ain't no fucking nuance on this album. And apparently Joe has been a hardworking kind of white blues guitarist for many, many years and has various products. And he's got a very slick website and his own fan club who can only imagine are late middle-aged men who are balding and yes. love this stuff. I'm not balding, but otherwise I fit the profile fine. But it's kind of amazing. I don't know if I can exactly recommend it, but I do enjoy it. But it's kind of like turning on a CD, you know, press the CD button, and then it's like a bulldozer runs you down for 40, 45 minutes.
Well, that's sort of like how the West was won, at least discs 2 and 3. It's just, you know.
Yeah, but again, I guess if you listen.
But with more taste.
Well, a little bit more, and it's not, it's never. Even the solo, it's like he is never going to go off the reservation. He's not going to like get caught up in, I wonder what it sounds like if I hit my guitar with a violin bow or if I listen to feedback it's not at all. It's like, here are some blues licks that you have heard 100 times before, but I'm playing them louder and here's some more that you've also heard. And it just, yeah, it's just kind of, wow. And it's like the genre was turned into cappuccino or something, or espresso. It's like boiled down to the essence and twice as much caffeine. I don't know that there's a single note that he plays that I haven't heard in, you know, well, lick, I'm trying to say. Obviously, there are only 12 notes, but it's very familiar sounding stuff. But it is played with a great deal of conviction. And she's got a kind of weird, I mean, it's almost an eerie voice. It's very distinctive. But again, not a mistress of subtlety. I don't want to hear her album of Billie Holiday covers. I'm just saying.
That's their next project.
Yeah, Sailboat in the Moonlight and You,
Strange Food.
No.
Hopefully they have the taste not to pull that one up.
I hope, yeah, not least because they're both Caucasian. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 139. Our Pop Matters segment ran a little bit long, but if you'd like to hear a few more minutes of Mike meditating on Live Aid, I've tagged that on to the end. So enjoy if you'd like, or just press stop when I'm done here. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com and mike@jazzbastard.com. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, or if you'd like, drop me a line at All About Jazz. The podcast is available from Apple Podcasts, from our website, www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, possibly from Spotify. And we have a monthly summary at All About Jazz. If you'd like to pick up the month's episodes in that form, they're available there. Tune in next time as we talk about music by Alice Coltrane, John Gordon, J.D. Allen, and Wes Montgomery. Till then, take care.
So that same article pointed out like the 5 best performances at Band Aid, and famously U2 kind of made their entered consciousness there with like an 11-minute version of Bad, which was, you know, by all accounts epic. They started out with Sunday Bloody Sunday, which talked about getting people out of their seats. Apparently Madonna had a really good performance, but of course the performance that everyone remembers is Queen, and Queen had been having a bad time before that. They had become slightly irrelevant. People weren't sure they were, you know, Freddie Mercury's antics were becoming increasingly flamboyant and overtly gay. And I think, I mean, he was gay, but he didn't care, but it was putting off fans. Like he was famous.
He named his band Queen.
I know. And, you know, and talk to people, like he never hid, you know, he's always like, I was reading articles about him, and, you know, people would say, someone would yell at him. Apparently at one concert when they were playing, before they were super famous, someone was like, get off the stage, you fucking poofta. And he stopped the concert and had them shine the spotlight on the guy and said, do you have something you want to say to me, darling? Like, that's the kind of guy he was, super awesome. Confrontational. So anyway, they were at a sort of nadir in their career in some ways because they hadn't had a hit in a while, and they had recently performed in Sun City. They had done some performances, you know, when everyone else was, you know, upholding the ban on apartheid. They went to South and performed, right? So they had to actually be talked into doing the thing. And you can Google their performance, and it's 21 minutes long, and it is 21 minutes. It's a masterclass of how to own an audience. It is sublime. I mean, it's just 21 minutes of, my God, that's what this man was born to do. And apparently you read interviews, and Brian May said, you know, we didn't know it was going to be a great day. And he said it was just like Freddie went to another place and we just followed. And if you watch it, they open with Bohemian Rhapsody. And they don't do the whole song. They do the part where we sort of get to the guitar licks and he stops and he gets up and this is a Wembley and they had a bad time. They had some weird time in the day, like 10 o'clock in the morning. He has 100,000 people on their feet. It's like, if you wanted to make an argument that rock music leads to fascism, this is the clip you would show, because Freddie Mercury fucking owns 100,000 people. It is breathtaking. You know, they do the Bohemian Rhapsody thing. They go into another number. He's got a sawed-off microphone that he's playing like a giant penis for the whole set. You know, he's constantly, when he's not singing, he's like, you know, he's holding it in front of his tight pants. He's wearing a white tank top, and he's in good form, and he's preening and prancing, and he's like pointing to people in the audience, and he's like establishing one-on-one connections with everything. And then they go into Radio, whatever that song is, Radio Goo Goo, Radio Gaga, and he has 100,000 people standing, clapping in time. And you're like, my God, he could rule the world. if he had a political agenda, he could say, let's march on Parliament and burn it to the ground. And
it'd be so much more fabulous, yeah.
And they would, you know, I mean, he's just, it's like, how do you do that? How does this guy in like 5 minutes own a stadium with 100,000 people? And it's like, you watch this, you're like, this is how. In between one of the songs, like one of the guys is getting the guitar swapped out, and he does this call and response with the audience where he like sings a note. He's like, wah, and then he points the microphone at them and they go, wah. And then he does this for like a minute and it gets increasingly baroque. He's just making this shit up. And the audience love it. They're just like, you know, the last bit, he's like, and he holds a microphone up, and they do it. He just owns this moment. And you see it and you're like, this is what a band does when, one, they're really good. Two, they've been rehearsing recently. They haven't been broke up for 10 years. And you have a front man who actually gives a shit and who has more charisma in his little toe than, you know, everyone else on the planet. And it's an amazing 20 minutes. You watch it and you think, My God, what a band, what a fucking band. And supposedly, like, Elton John was supposed to follow, and when they went off, Elton John's like, the fuck am I supposed to do now?
He was the next guy. That's never fun.
Like, what am I supposed to do, you assholes?
But it's interesting how much more seriously critics have taken Led Zeppelin than Queen.
Right. Queen's a great band.
Yeah, well, I think in part, Zeppelin's roots, which are now problematic. I feel like, in a sense, you see critics, or maybe more cultural critics, you know, questioning the way Zeppelin built its repertoire on the bones of various blues songs and their kind of wholesale appropriation of various, you know, riffs and ideas, and then questioning the validity of what they did now retroactively. I mean, there's even that lawsuit about Stairway to Heaven, which I think was stupid. I mean, yes, this particular little musical motif was used before. No fuck. Guess how many notes there are on a scale? 12. Calm down. You know,
right.
Just stupid. And this is a handy test, I think, for most rock acts. If it's longer than 10 minutes, the first question to ask is, was John Coltrane sitting in? Second question. Do I really need to hear this? And there are exceptions, of course.
Right. Bohemian Rhapsody is an exception.
But yes, I think that because Led Zeppelin had that blues grounding, in a sense, if the narrative was real rock and roll comes from through the blues, through 50s rock, you know, forward, they had this kind of legitimacy that, and of course, a lot of critics question what Led Zeppelin were up to as well. But the Queen, who were not grounded that way, and were, I think of more as a European band, even though both of them, you know, were kind of based in England, just people didn't take us seriously. And it's just interesting to me. I don't know. I've listened to a lot more Led Zeppelin than Queen, but do you have more on Zep, or do you have another?
No, I would just recommend for anyone who hasn't seen that, it's easily found. Don't Google the Led Zeppelin Stairway to Heaven unless you want to see famous people embarrass themselves. But yeah, Google watch the whole 20 minutes of Queen. I mean, it's a masterclass. Like, this is how you get 100,000 people off their ass. This is how you own a room. You'll never think of Queen the same after you watch those 20 minutes. Like, you may think that they had proto-fascist leanings in songs like We Are the Champions, you know, or whatever, We Will Rock You. But my God, you just watch them and think, this is what I want from a live band. I want a live band to own the room. You want to be lifted up in this sort of, you know, group experience. If you're not going to be overwhelmed by some instrumentalist's ferocious technical capacity, then you want the sort of group thing to happen. And it's like church. I mean, that's what it's like. You could just see how they own this room. So definitely worth looking at.
Yeah. The internet, YouTube, is not just good for Swedish people streaming video games and saying vaguely racist things. There is an amazing archive of music on there. I remember when Prince died, you know, that's when people turned me on to looking up his performance of My Guitar Gently Weeps, which is another one of those just amazing, you know, it's like there's this big band on, they're playing the song, and then he comes out and just plays his 3-minute guitar solo, then throws the guitar to the crowd and leaves, you know. It's pretty awesome. So there's moments like that, and the amazing thing is you can see them now, if you're lucky and the copyright holders haven't descended.